Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Good day and welcome back to America This Week. I'm Carrie Weber, Executive Editor at America Media, and I am joined, as always, by Father Matt Malone, our Editor-in-Chief, and today by Jim Keane, who is one of our Senior Editors. We have just finished speaking about the possibility of nuclear war with Father Brian Hare of Harvard University, and we're moving on now to a conversation, as Father Malone mentioned, that's a little bit lighter, but also has a kind of serious justice-y bent. We will be talking with David Dark, who's written for us before. He writes a lot on music and culture, and his piece is called Why Does U2 Irk So Many People? A Look at Their Struggle for Pop Hits and Social Justice. Now, are you guys U2 fans yourselves?
Jim, would you like to begin?
Absolutely.
I grew up listening to Frank Sinatra, though I was born in 1972.
A number of years ago in 2009, I got up at 4 a.m. to go to Fordham to stand on the lawn.
I was there too.
Parade. Right. Well, how long did we stand there in the cold?
My feet were literally, like, I was trying to, I can't tell you how cold I was. Yes. It was very long,
it was
very
a
long
very
time.
Very long time. And the U2 performed with Good Morning America. Mm-hmm. It was sort of a great moment.
And Father McShane, essentially. He'd give a little introduction, the president of Fordham.
Yes. I actually have another funny U2 story that involves Father Malone.
Ooh, do tell.
A number of years ago.
My finger is on the censor button.
Yes, exactly. A number of years ago, Matt was writing a piece on Robert Kennedy, and the moment Robert Kennedy discovered that Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated. And the line went, when he heard on the morning of April 5th that Martin Luther King Jr. had been assassinated the night before, and I circled it in the copy, and I said, Martin Luther King Jr. was killed on the morning of April 4th, not the evening. And when it appeared in pages, it was still said the same thing. And I circled it again. I said he was killed on the morning of April 4th. Well, then I looked it up, and it was not true. The reason I thought that was because of U2. Because in the name of love, pride, early morning, April 4th, shot rings out in the Memphis sky.
Right.
So U2 had completely corrupted my sense of history.
I admire your tenacity, though, in going toe-to-toe with me on Kennedy trivia.
And my doubt of your verity.
Yeah. That's questionable sourcing as well. Right. But that's fascinating. Well, and that's in some ways part of what David is getting to in his piece, which is the ability and the desire to kind of channel people toward issues of justice through their music and to inform people, even if apparently slightly incorrect information that sounds better for the lyrics, I guess.
Yeah, and I think also, Carrie, in a way, U2 has done it with different inflections over the years. I mean, from their very early albums to maybe a more ironic approach than to different sort of musical approaches over the years, too.
Well, to tell us more about this is David Dark himself, author of this article, Why Does U2 Irk So Many People? He is a teacher at the Tennessee Prison for Women and at Belmont University in Nashville. He's written for MTV News, and he is the author of Life's Too Short to Pretend You're Not Religious. David, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Very glad to be among you.
We are glad to have you. So tell us a little bit about what prompted your desire to write this piece.
Well, I have been thinking about them for most of my life, U2. I feel, as I mentioned in the piece, I would like to claim that it was my own study of history and Nashville culture that made me aware of the civil rights movement, or that I discovered Flannery O'Connor on my own. But the fact is, it was the catechesis of MTV in the 80s. That put them in front of me, and then all of these other witnesses came to me through studying Bono interviews and following up on their song. So there's a sense in which I'm paying a kind of aesthetic or ethical debt by lifting them up at a time when many of the current young generation really only know U2 as that band that got an album put on their iTunes playlist without their consent. So I'm lifting them up, and I'm trying to note that our skepticism and sometimes our contempt for what they're trying to do is born, I think, of an uneasy conscience concerning geopolitical concerns and that kind of thing. They've kept on believing, kept on trying, and kept on trying to be a righteous witness within the world when many of us find our hearts growing cold.
Now, I think Joshua Tree came out when I was in high school.
Me too.
I came of age with U2, but I've always appreciated them from afar. My musical tastes largely lie in other genres. But so it was news to me that they actually irk some people. Why is that?
This is recent. So if I can attempt a little bit of a trajectory, you had Achtung Baby in 92, which got a lot of people's attention. That has the song One on it, for instance. And then they had, in the late 90s, they had their pop album, which was a little more ironic, but certainly taking on commercialism, consumerism, and of course it can all feel a little contradictory because they're millionaires as they're trying to take these things on. I think one of their album launches for the pop album took place in a Walmart or something like that.
Okay.
And then after 9/11, they became... I recall MTV was still doing music videos a little bit in the early 21st century. And after 9/11, U2 was one of the few acts that could be put in rotation, at least in the weeks following, without it seeming really unseemly. Their earnestness and their general embrace of human beings, the songs on Joshua Tree, for instance, as works of mourning as well as celebration, seemed to fit the national mood. And but then after that, they became a band that for folks maybe in their teens and 20s, enjoyed ridiculing. There have been South Park episodes, for instance, kind of taking on what is viewed as Bono's hypocrisy as a millionaire trying to involve himself in global crises. So I think there's a issues fatigue that occurred, and U2 became that band that people would kind of roll their eyes at in a way in terms of their effectiveness.
Now,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, where do you think that comes from, that resentment?
I think that we're all stretched to the limit in a lot of ways in terms of the information that's coming at us, and we don't know what to do. I think that our conscience is worn down in many ways. I think we have, I don't want to use the word news media because that's this horrible generalization with which we can kind of lay blame, project our own despair on forces outside of ourselves. But we don't know how to be effective a lot of the time. We know more. We all know more than we know what to do with. So the question of neighborliness, real neighborliness, especially when it comes to what our governments are up to, We don't always want to follow through in studying what goodness and righteousness might involve. And here comes U2 preaching to a degree, telling us that our sisters and brothers are sisters and brothers despite international boundaries and that kind of thing. And it's just a heavy work that they are involved in terms of making us more aware of what we fund with our tax dollars, with our spending, with our votes. And I think we just aren't up. Well, we're not up for it a lot of the time, and we definitely don't want it when we're looking for a pop song. So there's a sense in which we don't want them to be prophets and pop musicians and political activists all at once. We don't accept that from celebrities. But U2 remains this, to my mind, mostly righteous corporation brand within popular discourse, but they're easy to pick on for that reason.
Yeah, you write in your piece about this idea of a lot of people looking at public figures, at celebrities, as sort of that one thing. Like, you are an actor, or you are a writer, or you are a musician, and often the public seems to resent people who try to move fluidly through these things or change from one to the other.
Yeah.
And what do you think is behind that sort of feeling? I think most people probably want to be seen as more than one dimensional. So one would think that we would have a little more sympathy for others who seem to be able to do that.
Yes, I think we are each involved in a meaning crisis many times a day. We want to keep it simple. We want to know who the liberals are and who the conservatives are. We want to say that's religion and that's politics, and you mustn't mix the two. So it's understandable, because we're each trying to survive and lead a more meaningful than not existence. And then you've got the poets and prophets who are also famous, like Bono, and I think resentment arises. But I, of course, I'm informed by the Apostle Paul in this, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but principalities and powers. So when I think of Bono or any of the guys in the band, I think of other people slightly older than me that I've known in my life who continue to try to live honest and creative lives. And I wouldn't want to deny that of these men in U2. And I mean, and part of my argument in the article is, why would we deny that of anyone, especially with U2 or Springsteen or somebody like that? They remain this gift to popular discourse that we're not always ready to receive as a gift.
David, I wonder if another point occurred to me when I was reading your article is this line from Fitzgerald, is that there are no second acts in American life. Mm. And that with Bono and U2, with their move from their fairly earnest 80s albums into the kind of ironic distance of things like Achtung Baby or Pop, mm-hmm. where suddenly they're climbing out of a giant lemon, or Bono's wearing fake muscles. Some of the resentment comes from that. And the parallel that I thought of is also in your article, is that with Thomas Merton, is that I think when Thomas Merton moved into more active political commentary, there were a lot of people who resented him because he had become a monk and he was going to stay a monk.
Yes.
And he was not supposed to come out. There was not going to be a second act for Thomas Merton. And I think that culturally has a role to play too.
Yes, I of course think of Daniel Berrigan, who there's a sense in which his activism led people to neglect him as a poet, even an actor appearing in The Mission at one point. And I think we like to know where to put people. We think in mental shortcuts of labeling someone and saying that's what they are. And we, again, with the religion and politics, I think it's William Kavanaugh who said the difference between religion and politics wasn't discovered, it was invented. And that line really guides our thinking and our attempt to manage chaos, and we don't enjoy it, or many of us have yet to learn to enjoy it when those divisions get disrupted.
Now, David, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the sort of ongoing but tenuous but uncertain relationship that U2 seems to have with faith in general. During the break, we were discussing the fact that I don't think any of us have ever been to like a high school or college retreat at which at least one U2 song has not been played. There's a lot of faith imagery and symbolism in their songs, although the Bono and company don't necessarily identify as Catholic anymore or as a particular faith. Can you talk a little bit about how they navigate that in their music?
Yes, I have researched them enough to know that that is tactical, I believe it's the case that their bass player, Adam Clayton, only within the last 10 or 11 years, has made a profession of Christian faith. But apart from him, they were all, as young men, they were involved in Bible studies. They were heavily churched in a way. And they It is tactical, and I even heard, I think there was a Newsweek interview with The Edge in the 80s in which they asked him, how do you identify? And he even cited the verse in Acts in which it is observed that they were, of the early Christian community, they were first called Christians in Antioch. So he went straight to a verse to note that self-identification as Christian is kind of a cart before the horse type thing, that you have to leave it to the audience to conclude your identity rather than let it be a public verdict rather than a boast. And I think they also arose long before anyone sold music by advertising it as Christian.
Right.
So I think there was a conscientious decision as well as a strategic decision to not make that part of their that self-identity part of their advertising.
But are you
And
suggesting
their
that it's
students.
somehow a kind of a conscious attempt to bring some kind of Christian sensibility or ethic in through the back door of the culture?
Yes, and to be a faithful witness without courting misunderstanding, because obviously the adjective has known better days, even in the 80s. Similarly, and I think that they're also students of the French sociologist Jacques Ellul, who writes a lot about propaganda and notes that if you use, once you enter into the mechanism of propaganda, like the mechanism of advertising, you are necessarily untrustworthy. They didn't want to enter into the false covenant of identifying themselves in that way when it led to all kinds of misunderstandings of what they're about.
I think they also see there's a certain reference to scripture in the lyrics all the way going back to the 80s that continues even through the pop and more synthetic songs of albums of the 90s and even to today.
The big what really struck me, and this is in the article, was Sunday Bloody Sunday off the War album. For these men to open with that, a song that is about a the Sunday Bloody Sunday event. And do I have it right? Is it Enniskillen? Would y'all know by any chance in Northern Ireland?
I thought it was Ballymoron, but I don't know.
Oh, I bet it is. I bet you're right. But they're riding out of that, and they're drawing on, the Beatles line, "I heard the news today, oh boy." But then they're going through recent history, ancient history, and before the song is over, the battle's just begun. Many lost, tell me who has won. Trenches dug within our hearts, brothers, sisters torn apart. Okay, I'm messing it up, but I know that it goes, finally goes to battle's just begun, just like the victory Jesus won on Sunday, Bloody Sunday. So he's identifying the resurrection, the overcoming of the forces of wickedness in Jesus as being of a piece with their own struggle as peace activists.
What is the significance of their choosing the name of a U.S. spy plane for their band?
Yeah, I think that is I note that Bono once asked Lou Reed, is there, he was looking for affirmation, trying to get Lou Reed to criticize their work, and he said, "I've never really liked the name that much." He doesn't like the name U2. But I think the spy plane thing is exactly, it's very much in line with what we were talking about
Right.
in terms they're going to be subversive. They are going to, like Springsteen, they'll sometimes say on a song like "Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For," "Let's go to church," and very much note that this is a conscious worship service happening. But I think it's also you t that the spy, the subterfuge, the sneak, it is their method as artists to speak clearly, but to do so lyrically in a way that it kind of sneaks up on you and you don't know what you've agreed to, like a parable.
So would you feel comfortable labeling it as Christian music?
If I know for myself, if I'm talking to someone and someone says it sounds like you're Christian, I'll say, "Well, tell me what you think a Christian is, and I'll tell you if that fits what I think I'm about." Because very often it means something that is antichrist, or which is the very opposite of what I think a meaningfully Christian witness is. I think too of Madeleine L'Engle, when asked, can art be Christian? She says, well, sure it can. If it's good, it's Christian.
Hmm.
Like, why would you mess around with a word like that? So I'm certainly comfortable calling them Christian artists, but I worry that that adds to the confusion that is currently associated with that adjective. But I think they're confessional, I think they're prophetic, and I think that history will judge that they were among the most effective and essential artists, period, but certainly Christian artists of our time.
And I'm always fascinated with how a concert-going experience can be very spiritual, and the ways in which it often sort of mimics the liturgies that we're used to, and the call and the response and the songs and that feeling of unity that's possible in the context of a concert that kind of creeps up on you and you don't really necessarily expect in that context, but which gives you that sense of community that can be really profound.
Absolutely, and that is what they're about. I know Jeff Tweedy of Wilco once said that people who come to a musical performance don't come to get to be apart from humanity, but they want to be a part of humanity. And I think that U2 is, for many listeners, the concert specifically, are among the most transcendent. I mean, that's why people keep coming back. They're looking to get out of themselves. And it's ecstatic, but there's also something of a altar call usually in terms of being challenged to view someone in a migrant camp on the other side of the world as a part of your family. They're just giving us that over and over again throughout their career.
Right, and there's often a sense of sort of ritual or tradition, in a sense, of the same songs coming up again, or the same shticks, kind of, or whatever the performers are choosing.
Yes, indeed.
Which served to unify.
Mm-hmm.
We received a lot of responses about this, David, about your article, and one that we received was a letter from a person who had previously written to very strongly criticize an article that I had written about Gaza. who wrote, but I thought you might like to know this. While I'm sure we can agree on the relatively uncontroversial topic of Israel and Palestine, on the awfulness of U2, there is and can be no dialogue. But I read the piece and found it profoundly moving. I can't say that I'll be blasting Joshua Tree, but the writer made me walk away with a new appreciation for a band.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
I'm so glad. Yeah. Yes.
More of us and less of that sense of other.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I thought that the risk that the... I really admired the risk that the reader took in reading the piece.
Yeah. Right?
Because, you know, we live in a world in social media where people usually just read the 140 characters and then they either submit or dismiss or whatever, or retweet or like or whatever it is that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And but here somebody said, I think I'm inclined to disagree with what I think is the thesis of this, and yet I'm going to engage with it, and I'm going to be open to being transformed by it, right? And that in a sense is itself the methodology of U2.
Yes. No, I mean, it's funny because he, I think Bono somewhere back there in the middle of when he would be appearing in photographs with President Bush or something like that, he noted, he said, I'm sick of me. I'm sick of myself in the news cycle.
That is a typical
Irishman, yeah. Yeah, but I have to do what I can with the currency of my own celebrity. And he specifically said, if I'm going to be the voice of those who don't have a voice, I have to be willing to take those. It doesn't even feel right to call them hits, because he is a billionaire. I mean, he's yeah, the risk, absolutely. It's risk every which way, in the same way that sometimes we're risk averse to being caught liking something,
right,
in a way. That's where I think the title, what is it, what is You to Irk So Many People, is such a good one, because it begins with, you may be someone who's decided they've had it up to here with you too,
yeah,
but let's give this a try.
What prompted you to write about this now?
Well, I did see them twice at the Bonnaroo Festival and in Louisville, and I'm one who drinks their Kool-Aid my whole life long. And I think I noted too, especially at Bonnaroo, because I was kind of close to the stage, I noted that he is older than Bono. All of them are older than I remember them. And I felt a kind of camaraderie, a kind of defensiveness, as he was in a bicycle accident that has made him less agile. He's noted publicly that he can't play guitar standing up anymore. He has to be sitting down. And so as he was bringing these songs to a group of people who he wasn't sure was going to be totally into it, I found myself kind of smiling and nodding the way I would if one of my sons was on a stage. I mean, it's really strange, but I felt a deep sense of kinship, and also a deep sense of it's time to make a case for their importance, for the role that they play in our understanding of things. So I think I felt more defensive about their witness than ever, and I was eager to make an argument.
The article is Why Does U2 Irk So Many People? A Look at Their Struggle for Pop Hits and Social Justice, which you can find at americamagazine.org. The author is David Dark. David, thanks so much for being with us, and thank you for your contributions to America.
Thank you so much for making me a part.
All right. God bless.
God bless. Bye-bye.
I can now safely say that my knowledge of U2 has expanded 100-fold.
Well, you pulled it off.
You right. Learn something new every day you come to work, Matt.
Right. I know. Isn't that amazing? And, you know, when I first saw that we had U2 on the cover of America magazine, I thought back to some of my predecessors, say, from the middle of the 20th century, my predecessors as editor-in-chief, and I thought, are they going to be spinning in their graves?
Yeah.
But, you know, but I thought that this is one of the things that America does, and it has done since 1909, is, you know, when there is an epochal change in the culture, you know, we try to make sense of it. And, you know, whether it was jazz or whether it was rock and roll or whether it was the singer-songwriter of the 70s or U2, there's always been an essay in the magazine by someone saying, how do we make sense of this as people of faith? And
how did
it mean
we feel
us?
About rock and roll? Is there an essay?
Rock and roll has got to go. No.
But I do
I don't think
we'll
ever
we'll
said that.
We'll have to look that up.
I do think one of the authors we published many, many times over the years was Father Andrew Greeley.
Yeah.
And in his work on aesthetics and... he had the famous line, beauty is not opposed to truth. It is truth in its most attractive form.
Right.
And I think in the level of culture, that becomes an important entree into honoring and recognizing the truth.
Indeed. And we want to, of course, end the broadcast where we began, by sending out our thoughts and prayers to the people of Houston and encouraging people, if they are listening to this broadcast and are inclined to help, to go to catholiccharities.org. Where the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, is organizing a relief effort for the people there. And we also want to be mindful of the people in South Asia who have been also hit by catastrophic flooding and natural disaster. So we had some good news in the broadcast, and we had some not-so-good news.
That is how life works, I guess.
Yeah, it's a mixture of lights and shadows, right?
Indeed.
Well, you've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. To learn more about the stories that you heard about today, you can go to americamagazine.org. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at AmericaMag. And to subscribe to America Magazine, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533. For a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Jim Keane and Carrie Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.